You're listening to The Psychedologist. This is Consciousness Positive Radio. This is the first episode of a two-part series with contributors to Bodily Autonomy, Decolonizing Sex Work and Drug Use. The book is coming out on May 14th, and you can currently pre-order your copy at Synergetic Press. Links are in the show notes. In this conversation, Melody and Jay share so many nuggets of wisdom and experience from the realms of sex work, drugs, gender, religion and spirituality, consent, and altered states of consciousness. Melody Garcia, MPA, is the co-director for New Moon Network, an activist-led intermediary funder and capacity builder advancing sex workers' rights in the USA. Melody is a published author, speaker, and nonprofit strategist with over 12 years of experience leading social justice projects ranging from direct services to advocacy to philanthropy. At the intersection of people, policy, research, and creativity is where you will find longtime sex worker J. Lee Oshiro Brantley. As a multiracial Ryukyuan non-binary person who has lived with disabilities, poverty, food and housing instability, and violence, they have brought this experience to their research and advocacy. Jay loves to support their sex worker and survivor communities by serving at organizations like New Moon Network and the Ishtar Collective. Welcome to The Psychedologist, Melody and Jay. I am so happy to be joined by you for a juicy conversation about bodily autonomy and more.
Thanks for having us. Really happy to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. So, as you know, we'll start with exploring what your relationship to consciousness was as a tiny human, as a child. Who wants to start?
Jay, you want to start?
Sure. That's always the who jumps in the double dutch first. My relationship to consciousness, I found this a really interesting question. And I was thinking on it. You know, it was pretty... I'd say it was pretty strong as a child. I was probably hyper-cautious, if that's a thing. I was very, you know, self-aware and highly attuned to other people and their needs. And I'm also on the spectrum, so I think that that was part of the superpower as well, of just, you know, knowing when, you know, perhaps there were like undisclosed motives about things that I could pick up. And I've always kind of been a no bullshitter. So I'm like, oh, I don't like that. Or I do like that, or that feels good, or that doesn't feel good. And so I had pretty simple language for a lot of the consciousness that came interpersonally, you know, pretty simple language of kind of knowing a lot what I think other people needed. And I think, my own consciousness evolved later. So a lot of the way that I was raised was really about being hyper attuned to externalities, other people's needs, other environments. And a lot of that was about safety, making sure I was in a safe space. You know, I didn't have language for that now. It's very like a trendy phrase, a safe space. But I think, you know, we're animals, right? And so as animals, we sometimes just kind of have those reactions or responses around things like safety, and around things like, you know, connection to other animals, right? Or to nature. So that was pretty attuned. And I think I was in an environment that fostered a hyper sensitivity to, I guess, the woo woo stuff, you know, the things that we would call spiritual. Maybe they're like a lot more scientific or energetic, or what language works for you. I understand them in a different way now. I understand them broader through different lenses now. But yeah, I would say pretty strong.
Thank you, Jay. How about you, Melody?
Yeah, this was an interesting question, one that I'm still kind of percolating on, to be honest. And I think part of that is because as a child, also, you know, being neurodivergent, but also having, you know, adults around me who were, you know, who needed a lot of things like emotional validation, had big egos, didn't feel like I was fully able to be in my consciousness. And it was it's almost like it felt sort of displaced, like I was less self-conscious as a small child and more others conscious, if that makes sense. And, you know, that really grew to inform my habits as a young adult, which I'm still very much, I think, trying to undo. But yeah, I mean, I can remember, you know, being a kid and like having like really vivid dreams, and then, you know, being in the waking world, and sometimes not remembering whether a thought that I had was a memory or if it was a dream. And so sometimes, you know, sometimes I would play with that and like had a really fun time being imaginative and like kind of being a waking dreamer, right? But then when it came to like, you know, doing things that, being present in the world in such a way that like you're able to be well adjusted, like setting boundaries and, you know, picking up good eating habits, my consciousness was like not there at that point. So yeah, mixed bag for consciousness.
Feels like there's a thread through both of your shares that I also resonate with, of consciousness of the other humans and being safe and navigating via having to feel and read what they were bringing, which, you know, I have a lot of skills thanks to that. I'm not totally sorry. But at the same time, there's like, oh, that's a thing. I bet that some listeners might be resonating as well.
I'm curious if you all see that directly tied into gender. I've framed it in a lot of ways. I'm non-binary, but I was assigned female at birth. And I think where I was in the world was very much about socializing AFAB people in a certain type of way to be attuned to, well, you know, some of the things we just talked about, right? Safety, right? Walking around the world with this body has its own particularities. And a lot of those are tied into physical safety. And I've tried to explain this to folks that are, you know, cis men, and in a way that sometimes they just don't really kind of understand it, around safety, but also around need and service. And I think, I'm from the South, so AFAB people in the South are highly socialized to be attuned to the needs of others, to serve, to be a good host, to be nice, right? To be agreeable, not take up too much space, not make too much waves. So I'm just curious if that was tied into gender for y'all.
You know, that's a really good question. I grew up with a single mom. So it's really hard for me to, it's almost hard for me to like compare against the zero data set that I have. You know what I mean? But I think there is something to that, because in my experience, I mean, I was also very much socialized to like be a good host and to, you know, be polite and to not say, you know, necessarily what's on my mind and things like that. But then also, like, there was an element of, not only gender, but like class, because we were like struggling poor. We weren't like destitute usually, but like, you know, we'd straddle some lines. And my mom always really wanted us to like try to play class drag a little bit when we were like, you know, inviting other people over or, you know, out in the world, you know, making sure that the house was tidier than it had ever been when a guest was coming over, or like doing things out of the ordinary to like appease people. And I remember her being like, my mom being like absolutely mortified when I would do something that was like a little bit like weird or, you know, not within that pattern. So yeah, I'm curious though what your experience with that is, Jay, and also you, Leia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for bringing class up. I was thinking about that as well. In my personal case, I feel like reading the needs of others was part of getting my belonging needs met. And that does have to do with being socialized female. Though I think just also the adults around me, and I did not have any other kids around me. I actually didn't meet other kids besides my cousin. I didn't meet other kids that weren't family until I was in preschool at age 3 going on 4. And I remember thinking, why do they run and scream? Like, I don't, what is that? What are they doing? It just was always around adults. And I think that these adults had ego needs that it was really easy to project onto a child, especially a really gregarious, outgoing, wanting to connect child as I was. So that's what I'll throw into the pot there. Don't know if you want to add anything, Jay or Melody.
Well, I first of all want to say that I now have my new favorite phrase, class drag. So thank you for that, Melody. I'm going to need you to write a book about that real quick. I'm just going to say that real quick.
I'm not the first one to coin that term.
I Googled it and it just came up like drag racing. And I was like, okay, well, someone needs to write a book about that. And I'm like,
okay, I got you.
And I'll definitely read it. But I think class drag is very much resonates with me. I grew up in a mixed cultural and mixed racial family. Certainly that was a big part of it. You know, not living within our means was very much a staple of existence. And, you know, and that was tied into a lot of religion kind of things, just this idea of living outside of one's means and putting, you know, religious institutions above actual, like, basic needs of the family. Very common in the South, especially amongst like evangelical Christian traditions. Make sure you tithe. You don't have food in your house, but, you know, get that 10%. So there was a lot of that. And I think, you know, I think that, you know, that class drag of sort of, you know, not so much like a keeping up with the Joneses, because Lord knows I would have loved to have a clean house, but it was more of, you know, sort of faith living outside of one's means. And I think that that created a lot of safety issues. I think that created a lot of challenges growing up, being poor, but trying to hang out with middle-class people and pretend that we were. However, the other side of that is, growing up in such hyper, you know, religious environment gave me opportunities to connect with spirituality in a very intimate way at a very young age, and a very personal way. And I think that as it's shifted and morphed across time and space, I just still see remnants of something that feels close to me still, even though I have very different language for it now and I understand in very different ways. I feel the residue of that, and not in a bad way. the care, you know, that a lot of religions sometimes misguidedly so, but they do try to center care, whether it's caring for folks, you know, within that class structure. And again, a lot of it's misguided.
Or
most
care,
of it's misguided, let's just be honest.
Some care drag.
Care drag. But you know, a lot of, I don't know. It's just, it's also like, maybe it's like something that we explore in the book too, of like, you know, the spectrum of how we experience substance use, you know, can change. And I think that that's my case too, with like things like care and religion. It's like, how have I used religion in my life? How has religion used me in my life? How has it been in balance, out of balance? How has it shown up with great joy? How has it shown up with confusion or moments where it was not a good experience? So I kind of not trying to make a connection that's not there, but that is how I experience that spiritual stuff now too, is how is it showing up in my life and how is it supporting the life that I'm already living? You know, not creating one outside of my own existence.
I really resonate with that, Jay. And it makes me think back to my own experience where I was sort of in not quite the same situation, but, you know, close to religion and kind of chose to, you know, go to church at a young age. You know, realizing more and more and an adult that like it wasn't the spirituality that like pushed me away. It was like people. It was like the people and the institution and the way that people like twisted the like scripture and like things like that. And so yeah, that just I feel like the thing that it's trying to uphold is, you know, often done in this kind of misguided way. And it's the piece about being able to like feel the residue of like a somewhat, you know, religious or spiritual upbringing as an adult has been really like healing and interesting and, kind of cool for me as an adult to like pick apart, because I too now have language for, you know, the way that I sort of felt in certain instances of being in church and like know that there are replicable systems of care within, or outside of like a sort of church or institutional context. And that I think is kind of at the forefront of how I am feeling about consciousness and spirituality and kind of piecing things together as an adult after, you know, going through and seeing all the things.
Wow. Something I really loved about the book was the heart and soul in what everyone wrote. And the topic itself is so, it's like everything. And of course, you know, I'm partial to, you know, I love altered states of consciousness in general, but especially psychedelics. And, you know, I think people should talk about the war on drugs more and just have more conversations about drugs and medicines themselves. And then some, you know, on the other end of that spectrum, there's the capitalizing on psychedelics that's happening in this moment. I'm not into that. But yeah, I'm just wondering, let's fold in this book and this really huge topic of the body and the spirit and what we put into our bodies and how we share our bodies with others. I don't know if I have exactly a question in this moment, but I just love to turn towards talking about the book and what's alive in you both around this masterpiece coming out so soon.
Yeah. Well, for me, the piece that I wrote, which is called Fuck Myself Into Heaven, very much folds a lot of these pieces together with, you know, sex work, the use of psychedelic, and the search for the divine, whatever that may mean to individuals. For me, it's very like being able to, as an adult, develop my sense of consciousness and try and understand and piece together my experiences as a youth and young adult through the lens of, you know, sharing my body, sharing my spirituality, trying to help folks as a sex worker myself, you know, trying to help folks do the same to their own bodies, you know, trying to find the divine within themselves and celebrate themselves, sometimes through use of substances, and have found, I think, on the other side of writing this story and revising it over the past couple years, is that, you know, the thing for me that really like fuels my fire, I suppose, is being able to do, I don't know, what you would call it, good, I suppose, or, you know, find ways to like lift others up, and through doing that can also do so for myself. And I guess maybe that's also ego. I'm a human and I like to have my ego sated too. So, but being able to like really like recount those lessons and, you know, make a thing out of it that's hopefully greater than the sum of its parts. It was a really healing like process, the whole like writing of this piece, and then, you know, doing some intros for the other stories that appear in the book as well. And I really like how the structure of the book moves from, you know, practical applications to like dreaming your wildest dreams about what liberated futures with, you know, in regards to sex, sexuality, drug use, can be those things.
I was just thinking about how it was reading Melody's chapter that inspired me to kind of go for contributing a chapter myself. So I was just reminded of that, Melody. And, you know, how sometimes when we are aspirational and hopeful and open, how that, you know, can liberate each other to also be aspirational and hopeful and open. Especially when we do it with a public way, and we do it with like sort of keeping that ego in check as much as we can, because, you know, it does be showing up. But I really was really moved by Melody's chapter, and I think, you know, this was a really cool experience for me. It was my first time writing something personal that was published. I've done a couple of public health articles, but this was something that was very like personal and opening as well. And I was, you know, definitely very, very honored to be a part of it, because the book was, you know, really robust and kind of really just kind of illuminating about how we experience these things that have great stigma on them. My chapter is called Pleasure as an Access Point. Right. academic title now that I fucking think about it. But that's how my brain works. And it came out as a result of actually having a conversation with the compiler, Justice. And as we were talking, much like we're talking now, just kind of being, you know, in the moment and following conversation, that's what came out, which was for me that both of those topics, sex work and drug use, have been an access point for me. Sex work pulled me out of poverty, going back to class, straight up, you know, pulled me out of poverty, broke through class issues, even outside of financial ones for me. So it was an access point that I did not have before. And I think that's really important when we talk about sex work. We can talk about it in a lot of different ways. There's so many ways you could slice that pie, but the economic one, for those of us who don't have access to upper mobility, we don't have access to financial security from family, parents. We don't have access to legacy money. Though the inaccessibility of economic stability for many of us keeps us in trauma. It keeps us in pain. It keeps us in unhealthful ways of living because we have been born into survival and we do what we need to do. But you can develop these patterns that just keep you in a survival mentality because you're always trying to chase that stability. You're always trying to chase that safety. And sometimes it surprises people when I tell that. I'm like, sex work is probably the most stable fucking thing I ever did for myself. Because it gave me that autonomy over my body. It gave me access to my gender in a way I didn't have access to it outside of sex work. You know, it was the first place that I was affirmed being transgender. It was the first place that said, wow, you really like bossing people around. I'd love to pay you for that, right? So these things that were very problematic growing up, right? Being AFAB, being socialized to be demure and to be deferential was not at all who I was. And so, of course, I shot my dumb mouth off all the time, you know, just being honest about things. This is the first place that I found power, is the first place I found opportunity. And it was the first place where my labor was actually valued for what I felt it was worth, you know, working for other people, working for, you know, minimum wage in a way that was like, that is not designed to get people stable. Minimum wage is not designed to get people out of poverty. It is designed to keep us in poverty. And, you know, so although I've done a wide range of types of sex work, some of them not so privileged, some of them I got to make rent. Some of them on the street. I've also had majority of my experience in a more privileged end of sex work. And I've said it before and I put it in a chapter, but it saved my life, you know? And, you know, the converse of that with, I guess it's not the converse, but the other side of that with drug use as well was much like different, actually, because I grew up with a family member that was deeply entrenched into addiction. And so I grew up on a very different side of substance use, one that is quite painful. And so I didn't really have, you know, a lot of attraction to using substances until I got into my 20s. And I was very hesitant about it. And I was very, you know, concerned around safety once again, and safety for myself, safety for the experience. It wasn't a bad thing how I approached it, but it was certainly not. I was not experimenting with drugs as a teenager. I wasn't doing that kind of stuff. I was a designated driver when all my friends were. You know, that hyper responsibility. But I like that about my own journey. Some people have different journeys and that's completely wonderful for them. But mine was very different. And being able to connect with substance use later on in life was a really good thing for me. I'm a little bit of a tortoise in that regard. I'm a late bloomer. And so it's consistently been wonderful as I've experimented with different substances and experiences and sexuality with substances. And I know that's not everybody's experience, but it sure as hell was mine. And I don't know that if that's because it was delayed. I don't think it's that simple. I'm just saying that that was my own path. So, yeah.
Wow. Thank you both for sharing so much and so candidly. And in, you know, in the book as well as here on in this conversation. It's, I think, something that folks who haven't been exposed to sex work beyond like the very distorted picture of the media and got the legal system and all that. I think people don't understand the financial component, the upward mobility, and as well, I think the other, I don't know if we'd call it the other side of it, but like the, for those on the receiving end, the tremendous privilege to be able to work with a person who's attuned and someone who's doing work in like in any realm of sexuality, that this is like, there's so much healing needed, you know, drugs as well. Like there's a lot of potential for this, something that the government has criminalized and yet is very, is like, that's very hypocritical as well. Cause we all know like what politicians are getting up to, like all across the board. Not saying every single one, but like across the board of like sex work and drugs, like they're not like, obviously the laws don't reflect what they actually think people should and shouldn't be doing, or else they wouldn't be doing it. But just thinking about, yeah, the healing potential of this, and then the abuse potential that multiplies when we criminalize things. I don't know if any of that is something anyone wants to speak on, but that's what I'm thinking of is, it, one, like the first time I really like my mind got opened up to another view on sex work was when I heard someone speak about the sacred whore, and this is an ancient thing, and it's not gone at all. I felt a lot of grief that it wasn't until my 20s that I could actually think of sex work in that way.
I would say same for me. I had a very like, and maybe this goes back to gender, but I had a very like kind of warped view of how I was supposed to show up as a woman, or a girl. And, and had like, for longer than I'd like to admit, I held on to some like assumptions about what that meant for me as a person. And I remember, you know, thinking that I wanted to do or was really interested in like sex work, porn stars at a really young age. But, you know, even as an 18-year-old, I had like a no nude policy, like don't send nudes to anyone because they'll be on the internet forever. And how dare you? And then I started putting naked pictures of myself on the internet for money. And I was able to just kind of like let that go. And I was like, oh, it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, I was just thinking about like the sacred whore kind of archetype. I think it's shown up a few times in my sex work career. My kind of primary focus has been as a technician and a bit of a clown, to be honest. I'd say that my sex work archetype was Mary Poppins. And yeah, it's exactly as weird as it sounds. But I was obsessed with Mary Poppins as a kid. This person who was like very dominant and very also deeply much greatly a caretaker, a people, a teacher, a guider, you know, and kind of like was bringing people together across class and, you know, magic, right? Lots of magic in there, lots of whimsy, lots of playfulness, but almost like a behind the veneer of sort of a stern au pair. And I think that's shown up in my sex work experience, is that I am a little bit of a jokester and a clown. I really like to have a good time when I am on a date. And, you know, it's my life. Like, I want to enjoy it, you know? And I think that there, you know, that's probably the reason why I haven't been a hyper successful sex worker on things like on online work and stuff like that. It just wasn't really where I wanted to put my energies. And also, I don't think I'm very good performing in front of a camera. I had a lot of experience behind the camera, and I really like that. Insert your own joke about being a control freak here. But I definitely found myself hitting stride on in-person work and being able to connect with bodies. Like, I'm a technician. I love to play with people's bodies. I love it. It's one of my favorite things. I love to see how they respond. I love to experiment with sensations, experiences, environments, role plays, and all of the things that, you know, that can happen when creativity shows up. So that's kind of 10, like, even when in the past when I've had wham, bam, thank you, ma'am experiences, somehow, you know, I've tried to really imbue them with memories, you know, with things that were memorable and playful and, you know, and I think healing has shown up in those spaces, actually. I think laughter is one of the most healing things out there, actually. It's also involuntary. When you laugh, you're affected by something there. It's hard to make yourself stop laughing. So it's a really powerful tool. And I think, you know, I don't know that I am the sexiest of the sex kittens, but I do think that, like, I'm a bit of a conductor when it comes to curating experiences for people. And that sometimes it incorporates substances, sometimes it doesn't, but I'm definitely playing with all those drugs that are inside people's bodies.
We're all just nodding so vigorously over here for those that can't see us. Oh yeah, I love that. I love that so much. That's why I always say, like, love is an altered state. Like, you think you're sober right now? You're in love? Like, you're fucking high. Like, you're on a
exactly
high,
right? Exactly.
Yeah, and
exercise,
pleasure.
Food, love. Yeah.
Well, because it's come up a few times, I want to ask, this is a contentious question and topic, and I feel like you two are, I'm so curious your response, if you'll share it, which is, what do you think about, you know, mixing substances and sex? There's like a, you know, that changes one's ability to consent. Anything on this topic that you'd share from your experience, your professional and personal views? I think that, you know, I hear people that work in the sex industry get interested in integrating drugs sometimes, and then vice versa as well. And I know that some people get really upset about that. And I can see a lot of abuse potential and a lot of abuse that has happened indeed. At the same time, a lot of healing potential and opening. So how do we hold that?
This might be one of those answers that we may have to revisit after we record, depending on how it goes. For me, I feel like, first of all, the way that we think about consent, I think, is problematic. We being society, right? Not necessarily individuals. But consent, especially from a legal standpoint, like, the laws will never be our liberator, I feel, point blank. Like, laws and the justice system are meant to serve a specific purpose. And we can do harm reduction around that and around, you know, public opinion on things. But I feel like at the end of the day, we're not going to what's that quote? We're not gonna build the house with the master's tools.
The master's tools won't dismantle the master's house.
That's what it is. It's the, yeah, this dismantle for sure. So for like legal definition of consent, I understand why it is the way it is and why people sort of fear it. I think what people don't really understand in those instances and what, you know, I mean, I still contend with this myself too, right? But like, I don't think that every substance and every instance of substance use is the same. Like, they're not the same, point blank. It's not, I think that's a fact. And as someone who is finely attuned to the needs of others and is, you know, intentionally tries to, as Jay so eloquently put it, like conducting and curating experiences for people, I think that there, you can still consent under many, if not all, substance use instances, because at a certain point, like when you're messing with psychedelics or with substances with another human, and you're in a space where you can, I mean, eventually you get to a place where, for lack of a better term, like you can kind of see into each other. You can see into another person, or at least I can, and I know others can. And I think consent is, in those instances, especially when there's substances involved, is like, it's not just a single point in time. It's like an ongoing, like every second there's some sort of like consent that happens, right? To like keep interacting with, you know, this stream of consciousness that you're going through, or, you know, to keep interacting with or thinking through, you know, a particular thought. And the same happens with bodies and with interactions, right? So I think for me, and I know that this is contentious, but I feel like if someone doesn't say something, I still know if you're okay. And like, I can still make a choice, even if I'm on substances, to like check in with you. And I think what my thought is boiling down to is that the assumption that people can't consent when there is substance use, point blank, in classes, because it's a false assumption that substances take away your autonomy, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, we see problematic things happen a lot, especially with, like, you know, the media, and, you know, shit happens. And I think the assumption that all substances and all instances of substance use take away your consent is a problematic assumption to start from on society's part.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jay.
I thoroughly agree with what Melody said. This is a really big question. Several years ago, I was able to work with a team on an academic paper around preventing human trafficking of minors. And something that we explored was the concept of non-volitional sex. Now, this is an interesting concept for a lot of folks, because it's a, you know, it's like a big academic phrase, right? Non-volitional. But non-volitional, in short, if you even go on, you know, Wiki or things like that, it's basically, it's not a matter of free choice. It's a really interesting kind of big and very broad statement. I have friends that are gay, and when they were in high school, they kissed women. That is an example of a societal coercion situation, at least in their case it was, where they were engaging into sexual activity that now is very much, you know, not wanted for them, right? It's not a part of their sexual experience. But they engaged it into it under duress, under societal duress. We experience this also, too, with the concept of human trafficking, which often gets conflated with sex work, particularly in policy circles, that there is a contingent of feminists that believe that no form of sex work can happen under free choice, because they believe that it is inherently coercive underneath sexist policies and societies. I find these things really fascinating. Like, I think that you could probably spend a lifetime researching them, to be honest, because it's a really big question. Like, well, which substances? To Melody's point, there are some that have a stronger mood-altering effect, a stronger perception of reality. Which substances? How much substances were you using at the time? Were they, you know, in a cocktail with others? What was your mindset at the time? You know, it's just the same thing of around consent. It's like just telling people, yes, I want to have sex tonight is not enough for consent. It's continuous. It can change, you know, depending upon your mood when you're in the moment, you know? And so looking at things in a broader way, and I think across the spectrum is really important. I'm not here to define people's experiences for them, but I do think it's important that we open up questions of like, well, what is consent? Right? Because under this definition around non-volitional, I really shouldn't be paying some taxes, because I did not consent to those goddamn taxes. And yet I am in a society that has coerced all of us under the threat of things like criminalization. We pay them damn taxes. April 15th's coming around, you know, come hell or high water. So I think that these are big questions. You know, there's this idea of societal coercion. For a lot of us that are more marginalized within the sex work community, that have less agency and privilege, if we don't have access to other forms of gainful employment, if we are trans, if we are visibly trans, if we are racialized in a way that does not provide opportunities for that upward mobility, or even to get our basic needs met, there is the argument that that person is experiencing societal coercion into the industry. So I don't think it's cut and dry. But to say that a person that has an overall societal coercion into an industry of any kind cannot have agency within that work experience across their lifespan and life course is tremendously misguided in my view as well. Because, you know, when I was working at Starbucks, and we say this in sex work spaces, nobody asked me if I was being coerced into my Starbucks job. But because it's sexuality and the stigma therein, you know, suddenly it's around, oh, are you really doing this of your free choice? Under capitalism, are you doing this of your free choice? That's a big question. So I always like to ask people, you know, how far down this rabbit hole you want to go? I got time. We can go real deep on it.
Now identify as a non-volitional taxpayer. So thank you for that, Jay.
So do I.
Definitely not consenting to what the taxes are being spent on as well.
Exactly. But there's the criminalization. There's, you know, coercive methods. I mean, just that one in general, not to go off on taxes and turn this into a libertarian podcast. But the reality of it is, like, you know, the government knows how much we owe, but we are required to, you know, to calculate that. We're required to pay it. If we're off, then we are subject to criminalization. Wow. How is that not inherently coercive and fucked up when it's talking about our very freedom? But, you know, this is a big conversation too, and in a policy discussion, it can show up around policing. It definitely does in our circles as sex worker rights advocates and people who fight for the rights of people in the sex trade, as well as survivors. You know, when they are in police custody, you know, can you consent if someone controls your freedom of movement? I'm not here to tell people that they can't consent, but I am here to question if it was consensual or did they feel coerced in that situation? Because the reality of stings, right? The reality of vice squads that gauge into sexual activity under the assumption that this is a professional transaction and then have the power to lock that person up, that removes someone's consent because you did not give them the information to engage in that sexual experience. That's my view on it. So I think it's a big, good question, and it's not an easy one.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you both so much for going there with me. And Jay, I'm glad that you spoke to something that was a big theme in the book, I thought, at least in the first half, about like certain feminists that say that sex work is always coercive. And I thought that the different narratives really provided some good inquiry and countering to that viewpoint. And like really actionable strategies for stopping non-volitional sex work and human trafficking from happening.
I had a follow-up thought on this. And I don't have the study at my ready right now, but I remember years ago reading about a study of a group of women that had been on hormonal birth control for decades. And the findings were pretty robust that after they got off hormonal birth control, most of them ended up getting a divorce. So going back to your question of can we consent when we are engaging in the substances, this is a fascinating one, right? There's illicit substances, and then there's these ones that we just do to function this world. Hormonal birth control is a form of mood-altering situation, right, in our bodies. And you are tricking your body to be impregnant and in a pregnant state for decades sometimes. So could you not consent to that sex? No. But did it change over time? For these women, it did. So, you know, in the same way that sometimes during a moon cycle, you're attracted to a certain type of person or experience outside of that moon cycle, you are attracted. And this is very well documented as well, because our hormones change and our hormones, you know, these are a form of internal substances that we're experiencing within our body, mind, you know. And so I just think it's a bigger question of like, this idea that we're stagnant, going back to Melody's point, are we stagnant in the idea of consent? I think it's a bad question of if we are like this idea that we're going to be in or out of consent. You're not ever in or out of consent. It is it's an ocean that you swim in, right? That you reckon with, you know?
Oh. My gosh, that was like the most beautiful statement I've ever heard. Oh, it's an ocean.
Jay just got into Yale. So I would like to. Sorry, we can take this out if this is not cool. But I just like, I also was really moved by that last sentence and was like, yes, this, like, you got it. You got it. And I'm so proud of you.
I got the acceptance letter yesterday, and actually it is tied into this because, you know, I actually didn't think I was going to get in. I was very forthright about the things that we are talking about on this podcast episode I was overt about my sex work experience, the class issues, all of these things, and how I feel connected to my community and want to serve in and stuff. And I did it because it scared me. You know, I was like, you know what? Let me just go into this rich, white, privileged. Let me just do it. Let me just see what happens. And I actually did, because I was like, one day I hope to do a workshop at Yale and I want to say that they rejected me. That is why I applied. And then I got it. So anyway, the point of it is that sometimes being a hoe does actually work to your advantage.
Oh my God.
Thank you for that shout out.
They're lucky to have you. They're the ones making out. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, as we start to turn towards closing up, talking about consciousness hacks, I just wonder if there's anything else either of you want to say in this conversation. There's so much here. I wish we could just keep on going.
Consciousness hacks. The 12-year-old boy in me wants to say 420 blazing.
Yes.
Because that's what I'd be doing, you know?
I'm so with you.
That's my consciousness act.
I do love your consciousness as like a 12-year-old boy. Wicked. I don't know if I have any hacks. I think, you know, I am trying to get back to a place where I'm hacking things away. But to be honest, last few years have been rough. And so I'm just trying to maintain a lot of things that, you know, that I'm struggling with physically. And, you know, I have seen how substances have played a really big part of that. You know, I wasn't really using marijuana for anxiety before, you know. I wasn't really using it for stomach issues. I really didn't, you know, I used it a little bit for inflammation and pain, but I wasn't using it for those things. And so right now it's pretty practical in my life right now. So it's not really, you know, I don't know. I'm not really experiencing substances right now in a higher consciousness. I have a lot of those memories. I have a lot of those memories, but they're just more integrated now for how I'm experiencing and being with substances is just like really enjoying how they can show up to help me maintain, you know, a lot of the things I'm struggling with with some disabilities. And I think so it's a little more practical right now. And I hope to get back to, you know, that Burning Man vibe, but I should have started by echoing Melody's sentiment. Be blazing. Maybe blazing.
Oh, may we all get back to that Burning Man vibe in the good ways, not in the bad ways. Oh, gee. This has been so nice. If you enjoyed this conversation, I hope you'll pick up a copy or two of Bodily Autonomy. And I'll have links in the show notes for how you can get that. Do you two want to put out there any anywhere people can follow you or get in touch with you or your organizations, anything you want to plug?
Yeah, so we both work for New Moon Network, and we are fighting for sex worker rights across the U.S. You can find us at newmoonnetwork.org. And for me, I'm on Twitter, aka X, at @the_world_on_fire, and at Instagram at Melody KK, MelodieKK.
Could I ask if New Moon, like, how did you come to this name? I love it so much.
My co-director and the founder, Savannah, came up with it. It's very much representative of how we feel the sex worker rights movement has sort of gone, and like, this idea that the moon is always there, sex workers are always there, but sometimes they're obscured and sometimes they shine really bright. With this new organization that we created about 2 years ago, trying to project the brightness coming into fruition of sex workers and sex workers' rights into a visual climax, if you will.
That's incredible. Thank you so much. And thank you for doing that work.
I also just wanted to plug, I don't know, of course, everything is like trying to stay away from being dated with a podcast so people can experience it. But we do have a giving circle that we've just started recently. And if folks want to get involved and they want to support sex workers' rights, that's on the website that Melody plugged. And that can really, tie in some of your listeners into being educated around sex workers' rights. They could have a vote on where their money goes if they donate to that giving circle. So just wanted to plug that. If you want to get involved, if you're moved by this conversation, plug in. It's money is really what the movement needs right now. Yes, we need allyship. Yes, we need people to understand, but we get less than 1% of all human rights funding globally. So you need your money, honey. Plug into our giving circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Newman Giving Circle on Grapevine.
Listen to them. Give them your money. Give them your support. Thank you both so very much. You're amazing, beautiful, fabulous people. And I'm so glad to have been able to have you on the show. You're welcome back anytime, too.
Thanks so much. It was great chatting with you.
Yeah, this is a great conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.